convened, your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Our third in case today and last case on the January calendar, 04AP3382D, O'Reilly versus J. Anthony Felley. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Felley is Terry Johnson. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Terry Johnson. I have the privilege of appearing before you to represent the respondent, appellant, cross-respondent, Mr. Felley. Before getting into the details of the case, I'd like to just discuss what I think are some of the bigger issues in this case. And in one respect, I would hearken back to the argument we conducted in an earlier case involving Mr. Felley, something in the area of a year ago. And I recall at one point during that argument, Justice Prosser asking Mr. Crone, who also was representing OLR in that matter, a question of whether Mr. Felley was just a bad person or whether he was a bad lawyer, and that was why these issues were being pursued the way they were. Because, as I think this Court ultimately determined, by finding that that case only warranted a public reprimand for Mr. Felley, the position which OLR was taking in that case was, I think, by most views, somewhat at odds with what the evidence showed. Mr. Crone, in that case, quite properly responded by declining to answer Justice Prosser's question and saying that his personal views of Mr. Felley and even OLR's views of Mr. Felley really didn't matter. What mattered was what the evidence showed. And I mention that not because I want to plant the unfortunate thought in your mind that Mr. Felley is somehow a bad person, quite the contrary, but rather because in the context of reviewing this case, just as in the context of reviewing the last case in which OLR brought 11 counts against Mr. Felley, only three of which were ever determined to have been proven, the focus of OLR in its brief, and I fear in its oral argument here, on issues which have been resolved against it and which quite honestly could never have been proven and never really were attempted to be proven, may distract this Court from looking at the real issues, which is what is the evidence in this case on specific violations.
So you're not posing a good person defense.
No, I'm not posing a good person defense.
So as long as you started with that, I do have a question. This is in the Willsand estate. This is count two, but then we go, there seems to be in both your brief and in the brief of OLR, as I understand it, there was a attorney fees of some $370,000.
I couldn't quote the number, but it's something in that area, at least, yes.
Does anyone know exactly, do you know exactly what those attorney fees, they indicate they don't know what they are because they weren't able to get a complete record check of this.
I don't know that I know exactly what the total amount of the attorney's fees were charged. I don't think it can be seriously contended that that's because Mr. Felley didn't respond. It's because of the way in which I believe OLR's investigation chose to put together the numbers. However, I think I'd point out, and I will have addressed this later anyway, that is, number one, a count which was not found to have been proven. And the reason it wasn't found to have been proven is fairly simple. The evidence which OLR offered to critique it was the testimony of an expert, Mr. Pearlson.
Right.
And Mr. Pearlson admitted, Mr. Pearlson admitted, in essence, that he didn't know what Mr. Felley had done. And it is clear in reading his testimony, as the referee properly concluded below, that Mr. Pearlson assumed some things about what the scope of the work Mr. Felley had to have done, which turned out, once Mr. Felley described, admittedly not hour by hour, but in a generalized way, to be a rather substantial misunderstanding of what the scope that Mr. Felley had done. So that it only makes sense, as we pointed out in our brief, that the only way to compare fees with reasonableness is to understand the scope of the work that was done and compare the fees to it. At best, we had half of that equation. A second generalized point I'd like to make, and as I thought about this, I recalled the campaign of the late Edward Ben Elson for district attorney here in Dane County a number of years ago, which he used the rather unusual slogan, as I recall it, only obey good laws. And catchy as that was, it proved unsuccessful for him, and I don't think arguing obeying only good rules here would be a successful argument for my client. But on the other hand, I can't help but point out, and I think it's important to consider, that the thrust of this case is, in virtually every respect, violations of SCR 20:7.3F. That rule, I would suggest to you, is anachronistic. And all I would have to suggest to you is this. If the same day that Mr. Felley first met with Ms. Dipman, he had gone to his office and pulled out 1,000 envelopes with advertisements for solicitation of accident victims and 1,000 police reports, and if as long as he had followed through the procedure of filing those with the appropriate legal authorities here in Wisconsin, he could have sent out 1,000 letters to people who had never expressed any interest in even meeting Mr. Felley, much less retaining him, to 1,000 people that, as far as he knew, really had no claim, all they had been involved in is an accident, 1,000 people who had no interest in pursuing a claim, and solicited them to hire him for legal services. Now, I'm not here to argue about the wisdom of that. That's a judgment you have all made, consistent with rulings by the United States Supreme Court about freedom of speech. I suggest, however, that when the heart of this case is that Mr. Felley, in dealing with people who were already his clients, in two of the three instances, people who had been his client for approximately a year, in the other, someone who was a new client, is alleged, we suggest not proven, but alleged to have somehow induced them to take a step toward hiring him to do additional services, that is really not so heinous, even if you believe it's been proven. And I don't suggest that because Mr. Felley shouldn't obey some rules. We should all obey all the rules, and if they're anachronistic, bad rules, maybe we should have them changed or seek to have them changed. But in terms of what does it say about Mr. Felley's fitness to practice law, more importantly, does it warrant an 18-month suspension, much less revocation, I think it speaks volumes. Because the rules in general have moved way beyond this. And this is an isolated situation in which, for some reason, we have a rule which limits the ability of lawyers to, in a very minor way, solicit the potential additional amount of services from an existing client. Well, we permit them to do all kinds of things all the time to solicit services from people who aren't clients, solicit appointments.
This is the third time Mr. Felley has been up before the OLR. At least.
And again, without intending to say only obey good rules, the first one was a failure to pay bar dues because of a misunderstanding that resulted in a private reprimand. But yes, the third time.
That was 4 years after he was admitted to practice.
That sounds approximately correct, yes.
And within 7 years thereafter, we have a public reprimand.
Correct.
And now it's about 6 years or so thereafter. And we're in here for a third time, and he's been practicing law 10-plus years.
Correct.
I'm not one of the where there's smoke, there's fire school, but I find it unusual to have three charges. When I say charges, three cases. There are more than one charge per case. Within that short time period. So he obviously got the attention of OLR in 94. And OLR got complaints thereafter.
Correct.
Does that bother you?
A lot about it bothers me. I think we explained during the hearing in this case that many of the complaints in this case can be properly understood by the actions of Mr. Zarowski in turning clients of Mr. Felley against him, attempting to turn situations against him. I can't prove that, but that's, I think, a fair view of the evidence, number one. Number two, I would suggest to you a second point, and that is that, and I will use Mr. Pearlson as an example. I don't mean to suggest here that Mr. Pearlson is an unethical lawyer at all. I know Mr. Pearlson. I've used Mr. Pearlson as an expert witness. He comes from a very good firm. This referee determined that he believed that the practices Mr. Pearlson testified to that he followed in dealing with this murky, uncertain situation of what under Gulbenkian and Rule 27.3 is permitted in terms of dealing with clients who are having difficulty picking a fiduciary, This referee said that what Mr. Pearlson had described was, in his view, I can't quote it, possibly, likely a violation of the rules. Now, I'll ask you this. Let's be realistic. Is there any chance that OLR is going to bring a complaint against Mr. Pearlson? No. There isn't. Even though Mr. Pearlson's testimony is there, the record is there, there's no doubt about what Mr. Pearlson has done. And again, I'm not suggesting they should in any way. But the difference is a perception by OLR as to what should be done. And I use this as a simple example to show that perhaps we ought not read as much into this, because in the same case we have a successful long-term lawyer of well regard testifying to conduct which the referee condemned, and we all know there's not going to be any complaint filed against him. It is because of the difference in a lawyer's perception.
Does it bother you the referee condemned it without a hearing, without explanation, without an opportunity to be heard?
Well, I think he had an opportunity to be heard. He testified about it. Does it bother me? Does it make it different? Yes, it makes it different. But OLR was right there. They heard the testimony. They know what the referee said. And I'm telling you, I knew that day. I know you know there's never going to be a complaint filed. And I'm not suggesting there should be. I guarantee you, if Mr. Felley had been testifying in that hearing as a witness, and Mr. Felley had said those things, and the referee had said at the end of the hearing, I have some concerns about what Mr. Felley described, there would be an investigation and a complaint.
So you think they're out to get him?
I think they have reached the prosecutorial discretionary decision that Mr. Felley should not be a lawyer, and that, as a result, whatever complaints are brought against him are viewed differently.
They view him as a bad guy.
Yes. And that's why I brought up the first point, is that I think you need to get past that, because we have to look at the evidence, not OLR suspicions, and much of what OLR says it proved, it simply didn't prove.
Well, let's get past good guy, bad guy, prosecutorial discretion, and look at the evidence.
And having brought that up, I will. Let me move to the third point. The third point is the rule is fairly clear. The rule, two rules in Wisconsin that apply to this. The first is 7.3, which says, except as permitted under circumstances which are not relevant here, a lawyer at his or her instance shall not draft legal documents, etc., that require, imply, or imply that his services be used in relation to that document. The rule clearly requires that there is not a violation unless the appointment is made at the instance, in this case, of the lawyer. The rule therefore requires that OLR prove that the appointment was made at the instance of the lawyer, and other rules say that evidence has to be clear, convincing, and satisfactory. Although the referee found in an error of law that it was relevant to this issue, I think the referee found it was controlling that the evidence didn't show that Mr. Felley had adequately explained alternatives. The fact of the matter is, there's nothing in the rule that says that's required. Now, it may be required by good practice, it may be required in the exercise of reasonable care, but even if we were to concede, which we do not, in fact, the evidence is strongly to the contrary, that Mr. Felley did not explain alternative trustees to any of these three ladies, that fact in and of itself doesn't establish a violation of the rule. Then we look to the secondary authorities.
Well, at least it would show a pattern of what this attorney did and how he handled things, wouldn't it?
First of all, I disagree with that, and second of all, in the facts of this case, it doesn't show that. It doesn't show a pattern. It's like saying he has a pattern of wearing a blue suit. If it's irrelevant to the rule, if it's not a legally required step, if you have not said by your rules, and when the lawyer does draft legal documents which draft this, the lawyer must explain alternative appointments before accepting the appointment.
But don't you think an inference can be drawn when three people draft wills naming what documents, naming him? You don't think so?
No. Your Honor, you could come in and find in the last 12 years three clients of mine. I wouldn't say could say anything about me.
Be careful, because if you make an admission, you may be charged.
I'm going to be careful.
Maybe you better use another example.
Hypothetically speaking,
I'm tempted to use Mr. Crone, but I won't do that. Hypothetically speaking, you could find three clients that I have interacted with out of the hundreds in a comparable situation who would say something. Now, they wouldn't necessarily, I'm not saying it's even a bad thing. They could say, I remember that on the day that I had an appointment with Mr. Johnson, he was 10 minutes early for the appointment. I guarantee you that would not show any proof of a pattern. That would show three exceptions. Three out of 100 or thousands, as the evidence shows, doesn't show anything.
Well, counsel, I practiced law for 14 years, did a lot of wills, did a lot of documents. We always advised the client not to name us. And if the client wanted to name us, we explained the issues.
Well,
and
in this,
seemed to us under, was it the Collentine case when I was practicing law? And about the necessity. I mean, this is an area where lawyers should bend over backwards and forwards.
And the unrebutted testimony in this case is that that's what Mr. Felley did. There isn't any testimony in this case to rebut Mr. Felley's testimony about how he interacted with these clients. None of the clients testified, for obvious reasons in all three instances. But the fact of the matter is, there isn't any contrary testimony, which gets me to the third point. One of the issues which this case presents, which I think goes far beyond this, the confines of this case, is what does this court mean when it says there's a rule that says OLR must prove the elements of the offense by evidence which is clear, convincing, and satisfactory? I suggest OLR thinks that means, and this referee concluded it meant, that if there is evidence from the respondent, the attorney, that says, I did X, and demonstrating that he didn't do X is part of the element of the case, arguing that he's not believable satisfies the burden of proof. And I say to you, that makes a mockery of the burden of proof. That means if no one came in and said anything at all, that would be proof by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence that the lawyer had failed to do what he'd done. And that's just absence of proof entirely.
I want to go back to the Will Sand estate. And it seems to me, and I want you to correct me, because I was under the understanding, that's why I asked you about the amount of money, that Mr. Felley, at the bottom of page 904, admits over the course of 6 years, he probably billed the Wiesland estate $250,000 to $300,000, which would be roughly $50,000 a year for handling.
Okay. I don't dispute that. You raised the $370,000 number, and I don't know the
I was trying to get the number. And we've got what OLR surmised and had their expert, and then his own admission, which he probably billed them between $250,000 and $300,000.
But what we don't have is anyone except Mr. Felley with knowledge of what Mr. Felley did who can say whether that fee is reasonable or not, because Mr. Carlson testified quite clearly that he didn't have any idea what Mr. Felley had actually done. Well, now,
I was just going to say, and wasn't this the same estate where at least two checks, one was to a Daniel law firm up in Berlin, Wisconsin, I believe. Well, there wasn't a check to Gagno. The check was really to your client. And then there another detolan. I can't recall. I read this a couple days ago, but that.
There are two checks in which Mr. Felley erroneously described the payee on the check early on in the investigative.
Yeah, and he was the payee, really.
As it turned out, yes.
And not the people he.
Correct. All that was properly identified long before these numbers were talked about at the hearing. There's no question my client made an error.
Is it your position that these fees we're looking at are not over and above the norm? That this we don't know, we should say that we don't have enough evidence, and out of $1 million estate, his fees were $300,000 for his work.
Well, my position is this. As a lawyer practicing law in this state, I expect to be judged by the rules. The rules say they have the burden of proof. The rules say they have the burden of proving not just by the preponderance of the evidence, but by clear, convincing, and satisfactory evidence what the charges are. And to come in and say that because you charged X dollars in fees, that that's an unreasonable fee without informing your expert of what the true scope of the work was and without ever having that expert address that question is not proving that. And I think after the fact saying, because the fees are large, what would one say about Mr. Habish's fees in the Miller Park case? Again,
seemed quite reasonable to the court.
I'm sure they seem quite reasonable to Mr. Habish, and I think Mr. Habish, myself, earned every penny. But how would one know whether whatever he charged was reasonable without knowing what Mr. Habish did? That's exactly what Mr. Prosen said. That's exactly what counsel will be here saying. And that's exactly what the referee rejected by saying he just didn't prove it.
So, this is no retort for that, but remember there's a difference between a contingent fee and an hourly fee, which your client was working on. He wasn't working on a contingency, was he?
Correct. And he submitted hourly bills.
Right. Right. Well, but there's a difference.
I understand there is. But are you suggesting there aren't lawyers who charge $250,000 for handling matters over a period of years? I will tell you, I have charged $250,000 for handling matters.
Counsel, it depends on the matter. It
Correct.
Depends on what was done.
Correct.
I'm just asking the question.
And I'm trying to answer them.
I realize that.
If all you told me was that someone handled an estate for a period of years and charged between trustees' fees and attorneys' fees $250,000 to $300,000 and then said, does that prove that the fee was unreasonable, I would say, I have no idea. I would say, it happened no more.
How much was the estate?
The estate at the time the trust were established was something over $1 million. I don't recall the exact number.
So the attorney got a contingent fee of a third.
Well, he got 25% to 30%. I think it's actually a little less than that because I think it was more than $1 million. Mr. Felley explained there were, I think, three separate lawsuits that had to be handled. There was an extensive problem with a woman who lived as something of a hermit for years where they would find paychecks and stock certificates that were years old buried in piles of newspapers that he had to then spend time going back to find out whether these checks could still be cashed, whether the stock had been sold, whether substitute. The problems that he encountered in this estate are kind of a type I would not want to deal with. But that's not the point. It doesn't matter whether I suspect, if I did, that it's possible that Mr. Felley charged too much. What matters is, was the evidence at the hearing sufficient to determine that OLR had shown by clear, convincing, and satisfactory proof that it was too high? And just against that standard, I suggest there's no issue here.
Did OLR ask for your attorney, for your client's billings?
They asked for the billings. They asked for enormous amounts of information. And with a few exceptions, we provided them with enormous amounts of information. As we admitted in our brief, Mr. Felley's response to their requests was not perfect. It was still substantial, sustained over a long period of time.
But didn't you give them?
The things which they've itemized. In some instances, we made some mistakes about some checks. In some instances, we didn't provide some trust records as fast as possible. Mr. Felley explained, the other trustee confirmed, that that was because the co-trustee objected strongly to producing the materials. Mr. Felley was not a free agent. He was one of two trustees and had no authority to force the trust to do anything. So this is not a situation in which Mr. Felley just routinely blew this off and said, I'm not going to respond. What happened is Mr. Felley responded substantially over an extended period of time, producing the overwhelming majority of everything OLR asked for. His performance in some respects fell slightly short of the mark, and we don't dispute that. What we dispute is OLR's attempt to characterize that as being a willful refusal to cooperate with the investigation. Given what we did do, the limited scope of what we didn't do, we don't think that's a fair characterization at all. One last point, if I could just address it for a moment. One of the issues that has been raised is that one of the charges is a charge which wasn't even pled. He was never charged with a violation relating to one of the counts involving Mr. Rod. The referee found that he had violated a rule that he was never charged with violating. This, to me, is another example, if we're going to look at how the system should operate. It's not Mr. Crone's fault. He couldn't control what the referee did. But we shouldn't have attorneys convicted of charges that were never made against him. The question was raised with regard to Mr. Pearlson. Should he not have his day in court if someone's going to suggest what he did is wrong? My client deserves the same thing. The rules require a complaint which charges him with the rules violation and gives him reasonable notice of those rules violations. That doesn't permit the referee to decide in his decision after the hearing that there's a rule violation which was never alleged simply because something was referred to in the complaint with never being asserted as having been a violation of the rules. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Cohn, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Cohn. I am retained counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. This case, three counts of this case, there were 10 counts of misconduct found. Three counts relate to 20:7.3F as interpreted by Galbankian. And this referee's decision is a stinging indictment, in our view, of the estate practices of Mr. Felley, and rightly so. This is not a personal injury case. I can understand why Mr. Johnson says this is an archaic rule because doesn't want to look at the rule because it's been violated by his client. It's not an archaic rule. It's a rule that was good when it was announced in Galbankian and remains good today. This is not a case about Mr. Pearlson, our expert. And I would be happy to compare his estate practices with Mr. Felley, but I don't think that's necessary. Mr. Felley's practices here amount to no less than a switch and bait tactic with elderly people to gain a position of trust, to serve as a trustee, to reap huge financial rewards.
Is there a... Never mind, continue.
I'm sorry. And in Galbankian, this Court said, we realize this is an area in which it is difficult to police professional standards, but circumstantial evidence, as well as direct testimony, may be relied upon to prove that solicitation has occurred. Now, that's important, because normally in these situations, the testator is deceased, as in this case with one person, or is infirmed by way of illness or dementia, which is normally the case. Circumstantial evidence is important. Here's the technique. Here's the system of Mr. Felley. He works with a financial planner. They hold seminars. They invite elderly people, for the most part, who he deals with, are single and without significant heirs or family. They each provide services to this client, and they each promote one another. The financial planner does the investing. Mr. Felley does the drafting of documents. They promote one another. And in these two of these cases, we have explicit evidence, not circumstantial, but explicit evidence that the financial planners promoted Mr. Felley to serve in a position of trust as a trustee. There's clear evidence that there was promotion and solicitation by Mr. Felley in two cases through the financial planners, which is his alter ego in these situations.
How does this differ from situations where financial planners may, based on experience, refer clients to attorneys?
Well, referring clients to attorneys to draft documents is fine. There's no problem with that. But when attorneys get positioned in a position of trust where they're making financial decisions and charging for those decisions, trustee fees, that's a wholly different story.
Well, you're not suggesting, nor does Mr. Pearlman suggest, that an attorney can't serve ever in that capacity?
No, I'm not suggesting that. There are limited circumstances, and this Court has said that there are to be circumstances where that is permitted, and where there is, and they gave some examples in the case, it's rare when that happens, when there are unusual personal circumstances between lawyer and client, when there are unusual business circumstances, or where that relationship transcends a normal attorney-client relationship. None of that applied here. These people, from the time Mr. Felley got to know them through these seminars, from that first moment when he met these people, they were strangers to him, and he was strangers to them. There was nothing that, in fact, he admitted in a couple of instances that there was no unique purpose or reason for him to be trustee. So this case, as this referee found, violates the very ruling of Galbank in a number of respects. And were there adequate explanations as to alternative fiduciaries made? No, not at all. There were no adequate explanations that Cousin Joe could serve, or Mary could serve, or a friend could serve, or a bank could serve, or some financial planner could serve. no explanations of any meaning found by this referee. And there were logical people to serve in these positions. Ms. Wilson already had two trustees, two individual trustees. When they got a divorce, that same trustee could have continued in service, but didn't, or did, along with Mr. Felley. Mr. Felley didn't have to interject himself into that trust position, but he did. In the Dittman case, Ms. Dittman had an elderly brother. They suggest in their briefs that they were somehow not close. In fact, Mr. Dittman, the brother, said they were close. He had been in fiduciary capacities, including personal representative capacity, in all of her prior estate planning documents. Mr. Felley enters the picture. The brother's not even included, not even contacted. Likewise, with Ms. George, had a longtime friend of Ms. Bacchus, elderly friend, longtime friend, who had served in a fiduciary capacity in a number of documents, all in existence as of the time Mr. Felley got his plan in place for her. She wasn't even contacted. She knew nothing about the fact that she had been replaced and removed from at least one fiduciary position where Mr. Felley became trustee. These individuals, this brother, this aunt, or this close friend, caught wind of these estate plans and learned about them after the fact, learned that the stranger, Mr. Felley, is a trustee, making decisions, paying taxes, charging funds. They talked to attorneys. They were angry. Mr. Felley was removed. And members of this court, I can tell you that this referee found, right in the teeth of the Galbankian standards. It's totally inappropriate for lawyers to do in this state. The findings following this hearing, as it relates to counts 1, 6, and 12 that deal with that standard, were not clearly erroneous and were supported by law. There were a number of other counts in this case regarding these people. It's a very fact-intensive situation, and time doesn't permit me to go in much detail on all of them. But the findings of the referee were not clearly erroneous. In the Wilson case, we have this piano school that suddenly is a beneficiary. The financial planner's sister runs the piano school. The financial planner had been on the board of the piano school, but there had been no explanations made of that fact, a conflict. In the Dittman case, there was no discussion of alternative estate planners, no dealing, substantive dealing of taking care of accounts or taxes. A competency violation was found by the referee. Again, in the Dittman case, no proper advice as to who should be the trustee. It was Stan's doing, according to Mr. Felley. Stan is the financial planner. No meaningful discussion or giving of advice in that situation. And in the George case, the one that the referee thought to be most serious, a competency situation where the estate plan calling for charitable trust, in the view of Mr. Pearlson, was not in the interest of the client. The client didn't have sufficient funds. There were not sufficient tax reasons to even have a charitable trust. And the question was competency to even put the trust in place, much less serve as the trustee. And again, in the George case, we have the unusual situation where the financial planner becomes a beneficiary of one of the annuities. A clear conflict of interest for the financial planner. This court doesn't have jurisdiction over financial planners, but Mr. Felley's right there, knows all about it, signs, attests a document, and doesn't do anything about this clear conflict of interest, doesn't consult with his client, do anything about it. And so we have time and again situations in all of these cases where a financial planner takes, a financial planner is the friend of Mr. Felley, works with him, this Mr. Rad, and we have violations, and they were not clearly erroneous. All is found by this referee. What's important here as we get into the cross-appeal issues is the question of non-cooperation, because the non-cooperation
Before you get to non-cooperation, I want to double back with regard to your expert. You said you could compare and contrast, although the referee had some concerns about what your expert was doing. Compare and contrast, if you would.
Well, our expert indicated that it would be his practice to go through a thorough discussion with the client as to alternatives as to who could serve as trustee and the benefits and drawbacks of those types of people, or those institutions, banks, individuals, or whatever. No such meaningful conversation was given by Mr. Felley. That's the biggest and the most glaring example. And our expert person said that they were reluctant to serve as trustee, and in his view, if there was a unique relationship and so on, he would serve. But I would concede that there is a gray line here where an attorney says, well, you need a trustee, there's no one available, or here's one person available, or I could do it, and so forth. There's a gray line there, but that's Mr. Felley went way beyond that gray line. He not only didn't explain things, he knew of potential family members and others who actually had served in fiduciary capacities and who were simply bypassed, not even contacted. And he had his financial planner or himself promote himself. So it's a question of degree. You can suggest options, as Mr. Pearlson did, or you can have somebody promote yourself at a seminar to strangers. And you have to look at the totality of the circumstances to determine what's appropriate and what is not. I'm not here to talk about every hypothetical possibility as to what is or what isn't appropriate under Galbankian. I'm here to argue that the findings of the referee in terms of Mr. Felley's practice were not clearly erroneous.
Mr. Crone, you had referred, I think, at the beginning of your argument to this as being a switch in bait with elderly people and talk in terms of how some were deceased or infirm. Are there any other counts or individuals pending with respect to Mr. Felley that OLR is investigating or any other cases that are likely to come before this court?
Yes, there is one other case, as long as you asked. There is another case pending against Mr. Felley. We are awaiting the appointment of a referee involving his estate practices.
Complaint has been filed.
Complaint has been filed, yes. An answer has been filed as well. And there have been no findings of fact or anything. We're waiting for a referee. On the non-cooperation issue...
Sound like OLR is watching him carefully.
Sounds like OLR
is watching him carefully. Or is it that a complaint comes in, the name is familiar, you look at it?
I'm assuming, I don't make those judgments, but I'm assuming OLR watches him carefully, as they do others where they get complaints. On the non-cooperation issue, I would encourage you, if you have time, to look at pages 8 to 11 of the factual statement in our brief, because time doesn't permit me to go into that. But the referee did find there was non-cooperation. There was false information provided concerning liquidations of money out of the Wilson Trust. There were unresponsive answers given. There were no checks or documentation to document the $130,000 of withdrawals from that particular trust. There were trustee issues and fee issues that simply were asked for, answers were asked for, and never provided. Ultimately, the referee said this is a violation of the rule and non-cooperation. And the referee suggested that maybe Mr. Felley was making a trade-off. If you don't cooperate, you don't have to disclose information that may be harmful to you as it relates to these fees. And I think that's essentially what happened here. Because the cross-appeal OLR has taken relates to the fees. Two counts of them relate to the fees. Count two is the unreasonable fees. Both fee situations regard the Wilson matter. And it's important to note that the records that were turned over show that Mr. Felley had charged in the first 14 months $105,000. Mr. Pearlson looked at the charges, looked at the itemization, knew about the work that was done. And incidentally, not every expert who testifies in court is right there at the bedside to comment upon the doctor's practices in a malpractice case or elsewhere. So it's not unusual for an expert to look at facts and records and draw conclusions, as Mr. Pearlson did. He said this fee was not supported, it was unreasonable, and even based on the information provided. Now, the more important, well, they're all important, but the bigger count in terms of the fees is the $374,000 paid out of the Wilson Trust, which includes the $105,000. And where do we get that number? We didn't get it from Mr. Felley directly. We got bits and pieces from Mr. Felley. He was reluctant to give information, and so, as the referee stated, the OLR made a valiant, and I'm using his terms, valiant effort to piece together the fee question. and concluded that a minimum of $374,000 was paid by Mr. Feli to himself for either attorney's fees or trustee fees or a combination of both. The referee was disturbed by that, said it was implied that it was excessive and was very concerned about that, and said that there was a failure to cooperate to give over records, but the referee fell short of finding that that represented dishonesty. The referee said, well, you didn't show that he stole the money, therefore I'm not going to make a finding of dishonesty. But the test under the dishonesty statute is whether there's conduct engaged in involving dishonesty. And I don't know that you have to show that somebody in the dead of night with a mask on goes in a bank and takes money out of a trust. It seems to me if they're more sophisticated, as Mr. Feli is here, and drains this particular trust as he did over time using his practices here, there is a finding of, could be a finding of dishonesty and should have been. Feli was a stranger to these people, and the circumstances under which there was the withdrawal of funds was very suspect, as the referee determined. As the court might recall, the beneficiaries in this case, the piano school, at one point were concerned about some withdrawals by Mr. Feli, and as permitted under the rules of the trust, asked for an accounting. Mr. Feli, the next day, terminated them as beneficiaries, just when they asked for an accounting. And thereafter, charged, so we have at this, and Ms. Wilson dies, she's gone, she has no benefit, she has no heirs, no family, no spouse, no children. Feli is in a position of co-trustee with somebody that, according to the referee, he pretty much had the last say over, another trustee. And he doesn't have a beneficiary, and then these fees are being taken out for this so-called litigation. Now, our expert, Mr. Pearlson, said this whole pattern of positioning yourself as a trustee under these strange circumstances, discharging a beneficiary, charging these kinds of fees for work that seems to be questionable to begin with, to deplete a $1 million estate by close to 40%, $374,000, was wrong, and it represented conduct involving dishonesty, even though the referee fell short of finding that, saying it didn't involve stealing money. I'm not sure that there should be a distinction there, and I don't think there should be. The sanction, the referee's determination, I'm losing my voice. Good.
You're up here for a while today.
Doing double duty today, so maybe I'll have a little more water. Just to conclude, and I won't take more time on the cross appeal and rebuttal, the referee determined that an 18-month suspension is appropriate. Olard asked for revocation. The referee's visceral reaction, and I'm using those terms as he used them, was that revocation was too lenient. He said Feli showed no remorse. He feathered his own nest financially. His conduct essentially was deplorable. But if he's revoked, he then falls beyond the control of the court, according to the referee. But if he's suspended, this court can better control his practice because he'll have to reapply. Now, in all due respect to this referee who wrote a very good opinion on the substantive violations, I think when he got to the sanction piece, he got a little turned around because in my view, OLR's view, the most severe violations warrant the most severe penalty.
Don't you have to apply to get back in?
And you got to apply to get back in if you're revoked too. So either way, it's just a longer period of time. So either way, this court has control over him, and there's really no added control by reason of a suspension compared to a revocation. So there is prior discipline here. There have been prior misrepresentations, which includes prior misrepresentations to OLR. In this case, we think there's a real pattern of manipulation and deception and profiteering of very vulnerable clients, clients with no family, elderly folks who were taken in. Taken in by this financial planner, taken in by Mr. Feli, and who Mr. Feli did not reap great rewards in other cases, but he established trust and put himself in a position where he could do so. And in the Wilson case, he did reap strong financial rewards. So I believe this is a very clear case for revocation, and I think by revocation, but analysis of Galbankian, this Court can give a message to Mr. Felley and other practitioners that these kinds of estate planning activities are not to be tolerated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crone. Mr. Johnson?
I think they deliberately send a tall person out here so I'll feel awkward when I get up here.
Plan it that way.
This is a complex case in many ways, and I can understand easily how misdescription of what occurred can happen. However, there are some glaring things here that I think need to be addressed. And I ask that, and I don't know what procedures you follow from this point forward, but to the extent that it's possible to remember what has been argued here and compare it to the facts, I think it will be instructive. For example, at times Mr. Crone has argued that all these people had family and they should have been appointed. And at times he's argued these were vulnerable people who had no family. It can't be both. It's
well,
been argued as
several before. People. Can't they all be different?
They are all different. And as a matter of fact, the argument that all these people who went to the seminars are single people with no heirs and no family is, I am sorry, constructed out of whole cloth. There is simply no evidence whatsoever to suggest that. Just as there is no suggestion whatsoever as to a bait-and-switch conduct or anything of the kind. I don't know what the bait is, and I don't know what the switch is, but what is being done here is in being argued in the most pejorative terms that my client is acting badly without any reference to the evidence.
Well, how could one of the financial planners end up being an heir?
One of the financial planners could end up being the heir because, according to his testimony, not Mr. Felley's, except when he said he asked her, that's what she wanted. He went to his regulatory people, and they told him that there is only one circumstance under which he can benefit and what she would have to do. He testified that he talked to her about it, and she made that decision. There is no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Felley had any role in any of that. Now, I don't know whether that is right or wrong. I know Mr. Felley said when he talked to that lady, Ms. George, he excluded Mr. Rod from the room so that Mr. Rod would not be able to influence her, and she told him the same thing that Mr. Rod said she had told him. Now, if that reflects badly on Mr. Rod, so be it. I make no judgment on that. It doesn't establish any manipulation by Mr. Felley.
What was the relationship between Mr. Rod and Mr. Felley?
They had had a long-standing relationship of him helping her with her investments, and she had tenuous relationships with her family. And I think it's a fair reading of the evidence.
And Mr. Rod and Mr. Felley? What was their
relationship? Mr. Rod had been one of this group of, over time, two or three financial planners that Mr. Felley had made some joint presentations with. There isn't any evidence that they were particularly close friends. There isn't any evidence, I don't think, in the record that even quantifies the business relationship other than to say they had a business relationship. Similarly, as we pointed out in our brief, if Mr. Felley is someone who is manipulating these situations, he's remarkably bad at it. I'll use Ms. Wilson as an example. Under Ms. Wilson's initial estate plan prepared by Mr. Felley, there were five different appointments that could have been made if Mr. Felley was trying to manipulate her. He didn't receive any of them. It was only after, a year later, after he had done more legal work for her, and one of her selected trustees was getting divorced from her husband and didn't want to be involved anymore, that she says, the other trustee says, and Mr. Felley, excuse me, the other trustee says he was told, and Mr. Felley says that she decided she wanted to ask Mr. Felley to do it. Now, I don't know how that becomes a regular practice of taking advantage of elderly people who don't have means to make their own decisions. We have a woman who had made her own decisions initially, came to know Mr. Felley over time, had to make another decision, and chose him when no one in the evidence suggested any other likely candidate.
Your explanation is he's just a very good lawyer, and his clients, once they get to know him, want more of him.
Actually, not bad, Justice Abrams said. My explanation is that in an isolated number of situations, in a practice that encompassed, according to Mr. Felley, hundreds, if not thousands of people, there are a handful of situations over a period of a number of years in which people appointed him because of those kinds of circumstances. Yes. And how that becomes circumstantial evidence that shows he has an ongoing bait-and-switch program, I'm sorry, is simply lost on me. Similarly, the specific argument was made here that Mr. Felley furnished no explanation for why the piano screw was chosen. I am sorry, that is just completely wrong. There was extensive testimony from Mr. Zarowski, from the head of the piano school, from Mr. Felley, which on that subject was consistent.
I'll refresh my memory. Mr. Zarowski was another planner, wasn't he?
Correct. He was one of the other two planners that Mr. Felley had a relationship with whom he has no relationship anymore. Mr. Zarowski testified in most respects strongly adversely to Mr. Felley. In this respect, everyone who was involved agreed that Ms. Wilson was looking for something like the piano school, that she knew it was run by Mr. Zarowski's sister, and she wanted to do it. The argument here that there was no explanation given in the evidence for picking the piano school is simply wrong. If I could just mention one last thing. I ask you to compare what Mr. Pearlson actually testified to with what was compared here. For example, Mr. Pearlson said, I describe all of these sources and then say, I can't suggest to you that you hire someone from my firm, but if you want to have us do it, we can do it. I suppose it's anyone's value judgment as to what's solicitation of an appointment and what isn't.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, and thank you, Mr. Crone, for your argument in 04AP3382D. That ends the hearing on OLR versus Felley, and the court will meet at conference, closed conference at 3 o'clock.